It is Saturday, January 28th, 2012. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Cruz on the Central Coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio. During the show, we'll be taking your calls, questions, and comments about technology. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Thank you, Michael. If you'd like to make a theme for GeekSpeak, we'd love to hear it. Go to geekspeak.org and send us some contact information about your work. My name is Lyle Troxell, and this is GeekSpeak, and in the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. Hi, Miles.
Good morning.
So we'll go ahead and go over the Geek News segment of the program. In the second half, we will invite you to call in with questions and comments about technology. So if something aggravates you or interests you, please do realize you can call us and add your feedback. The phone number is 800-655-5877. And Miles Elam is a software engineer and a bit of a political junkie. And I guess, are you getting excited about the election season? Or depressed?
It's an interesting election season. I'll give it that. I'll just leave it at that. I'll stay nonpartisan on this.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and talk about some partisan stuff. Well, not partisan stuff. Let's talk about another branch of government. GeekSpeak makes recommendations all the time, and finally, somebody important listened. The Supreme Court made a ruling basically completely off our suggestion. Right?
Yes, completely off of our suggestion. We covered a year or two ago the story of a gentleman who had the FBI plant a GPS tracking device on his vehicle. And the issue was that they put it on his vehicle the day after a warrant to do so expired, and that made it warrantless, a warrantless tracking of someone. And there was a statement at the time with the court saying, yeah, you can do that as long as the car is available on a public road, that type of thing.
The lower court suggested that it was okay because since the vehicle was in a public space, they didn't trespass to put something on the outside of the vehicle.
Right.
You're not going inside the vehicle. You're not entering their property. And of course, one of the things that we talked about is that, yeah, sure, people that have mansions and can park their vehicles inside are relatively safe from this kind of thing. But anybody else, your car is in a public environment all the time.
Right. Well, the Supreme Court has ruled that, yeah, no, you can't do that. That is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. That is unreasonable search and seizure.
Well, I'm really proud of our, I got to say, I'm proud of our Supreme Court about doing this. I mean, it's definitely what you and I suggested. But, you know, so often we get frustrated by court decisions that seem to be not understanding technology. I'm glad in this case, even though, yes, I could see the argument both directions. You know, it's in a public space. You're not actually entering the vehicle. You're definitely not searching the vehicle. But that did feel good.
The thing is, the different justices had different reasonings for it, which is normal in many cases.
Sure.
But I thought it would be interesting for people to hear what those were. And you can read more about this by going to the website and checking out the news links, getting from the horse's mouth, as it were, rather than this horse's mouth.
Yeah, yeah. You go to geekspeak.org and learn more about this.
Mm-hmm. And so there's the question of physical trespass. You know, in other words, going to this, violating the sanctity of, like, this is someone's property that you're just going onto and attaching this device. But then there's also, there's GPS monitoring in investigations of, on most offenses, impinges on expectations of privacy. And so that's something where Justice Alito and Sotomayor agreed.
It's a detailed write-up.
I would recommend not just the write-up for it, but I would recommend people check out the actual opinion. Mm-hmm. Because in general,
they're wonderful, aren't they?
Well, they're not always.
I should say that they're wonderfully written. Like, it's clear with the thought process.
It depends upon the ruling, but at the same time, yes, sometimes there's some legalese in there, but for the most part, they're clear, concise, and approachable. They're a straight constitutional issue.
So to wrap up this story, Supreme Court ruled that it is, you need a warrant to add a GPS tracking device to a vehicle, even if it's in a public environment. Cool. Now, of course, this does not stop people from tracking people without warrants. It's quite easy. Cameras are all over the place, and it's very simple to take all the camera feeds and do optical character recognition, picking up license plates and track vehicles that way. And it's being done even over the hill in San Jose. Yeah, pretty regularly.
Oh, actually, the one other aspect was what's called the third-party doctrine. And that's where we give GPS information to various companies all the time.
Right.
Our phones whenever are feeding it. Whenever you're looking at a map, you've given GPS information to Google as to where you are.
Sure.
And you know, you have things like the carrier itself, Verizon or AT&T, things like that. And if warrantless wiretapping were or warrantless GPS tracking, were allowed, then it means that they could also probably subpoena
other people's data.
They could say, we want to get this information. We don't need a warrant because it's already been ruled that we don't need a warrant. So this is a decision that I think has helped out in the way of the digital age.
Sure.
Like taking that into account. And that's heartening.
This week, I work at UCSC, and this week the police department issued a warning about the puma, the mountain lion in this area. And I thought it was kind of interesting. The write-up they gave, this suggested list of what to do, comes from the California Fish and Game. And some of the highlights, the big thing about a lion is that it's a big cat, so running from it's a bad thing to do. It will chase you down. So if you've got children, you don't want them walking in the woods alone, you know, a few things like that. But one of the 7 points they made, if attacked... So what would you do if you were actually attacked, like the puma actually jumps on you, Miles? What do you do?
Fight back.
Good. So you've read it probably.
No, I went to UCSC, so we had training about this. Like you fight back, you try to stay on your feet.
That's the part that got me. Try to stay on your feet. This thing's the size of it's about the size of an adult male, right? They range from 110 pounds to 200 pounds, sometimes up to 280 pounds on the very rare space. And they... I want to know how easy it would be to stay on your feet if one jumped on you.
Well, the issue was how big you appear to it.
Yeah.
If you appear large, they're less likely to attack or continue an attack.
That's definitely the trick. Don't get jumped on.
Right. Don't bend over to pick up a...
a child.
Don't bend over to pick up a rock to throw at it.
Right.
But if you can reach up to a branch and take it off of a tree and then throw it at it, that's perfect.
A person squatting or bending looks like a four-legged animal, of course. And raise your arms, open your jacket if you're wearing one. Throw stones, branches, or whatever you can grab without crouching down or turning your
Woo-hoo!
Back.
My training from 18 years ago worked out.
That's great. And you finally graduated, too. Well, we'll go on. So the one thing I want to say is this. If attacked, try to stay on your feet if a lion attacks you. Lions have been driven off by prey that fight back. Some hikers have fought back successfully with sticks, caps, jackets, garden tools, and their bare hands. Since lions usually try to bite the head and neck, try to remain standing and face the attacking animal. That's a really hard thing to
do. I have a question, though. Yeah. Why is this being brought up on Geek Speak?
Because I think it's pretty geeky. I mean, just the idea. So anyway, I wanted to look up the biology of... So I read the Wikipedia entry, right? I love reading Wikipedia entries. And the puma can jump 18 feet vertically and up to 40 feet horizontally.
Mm-hmm.
And it weighs... It's about a human size.
That's if it has a running start.
No.
It can't do it from a...
Standing still 20 to 40 feet.
No, I'm talking about from a vertically going straight up. They need to have at least start to...
Anyway, why is it on Geek Speak? I don't know. I think it was geeky. Moving on.
Fair enough.
Of course, I've lost my show title. Let's see. Where are we? Oh, yeah. Let's talk about Android mobile phones.
If you have an Android device, be careful of the apps that you're downloading. Because apparently... there were 13 infected apps on the Android market that contained malware.
Only 13? Or 13 were found?
Well,
recently.
This one, that's this particular piece of malware that have come out. And
I see.
The thing about it is that malware in general is something that's been in the realm of if you root your device and put your own custom apps on there or go to something other than the official marketplace, then you're putting yourself in danger. It's one of the main reasons that Apple had said, no, we have our app store and we don't want people going out of there because of the security issues. Well, there may be some credence to that, because now the Android marketplace has been hacked by the Android.counterclank, a Trojan horse that installs, for example, into some games and stuff like that. People go like, oh, it's a lame game, but it's too late. Once you've installed the game and played the game, you've already had some of your personal data taken.
Mm-hmm.
And your phone has been rooted. But and there are 13 different apps that have had this.
The same rootkit, basically.
Right, basically the same exploit. And so, yeah, that's an issue. Symantec, the antivirus vendor, has a list of the 13 infected apps if you want to see if you've downloaded them recently. So if you downloaded any apps on the Android and you're curious about this, check it out right away.
We'll have it at geekspeak.org for the link to find that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Check it out right away. And Symantec researchers, when they told Google their discovery, they estimated that on the low end, a conservative estimate, 1 million downloaders. On the liberal end, up to 5 million.
Wow. Now, these are the people that theoretically all the data on their phones available, including all their history and everything. And potentially even people could bill against this stuff, right? Because it's connected to your phone, you could potentially...
Yeah, any data that goes back and forth, is absolutely billable. And that's something else that is what I consider much more threatening is the fact that we are now in an era where we have smartphones and we are in close proximity to one another or sharing a Wi-Fi link and the like. And we have Bluetooth links so we can see each other.
Yeah.
Like for gaming and
in the
like,
early days of computers, there weren't viruses that spread naturally, just happened.
Well, you had to download software and you had to install it on your computer.
It's not like that anymore, and the phone market's going to be like that as well. It should be at some point that you and I bump into each other, we happen to be in the proximity, use the same Wi-Fi point, and my infected machine infects your machine.
Right. Except that with a phone, it depends on how the phone's configured. Right now, I don't believe that it's an issue.
I agree.
But there is something on the horizon, like people should be aware that there may come a time where there is an exploit for someone downloads an app and it's coupled with an exploit for the phone. Like there's some remote exploit available for it, which means that you go walk as someone who has that infection, who downloaded their app from their house, perhaps walks through a busy shopping mall and suddenly everyone that they came within 30 feet of has this virus.
I mean, that doesn't exist that we know of at this point.
Right. It doesn't exist. But
the complexity of the systems, it just kind of infers that this will occur over time.
Right. Like this is a viable possibility in the future.
So you and I are both subscribers. We both have iPhones.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't currently root my phone. Do you root
mine
your phone?
Is not jailbroken currently.
Even though the court says legally it's okay to do that.
For now.
I don't do that just because of time and commitments in my life and all that. But I have in the past. Are we safer than a non-rooted Android phone, an Android phone that's just using the marketplace?
It depends on what the exploit is. If the thing is, if you have a jailbroken phone, it doesn't automatically make you more exploitable. Mm-hmm. It just means that chances are, if you're jailbreaking, you're installing apps that you wouldn't normally get, and so those may have holes in them.
Well, I'm not talking about jailbroken versus non-jailbroken. I'm talking about the Android App Store, which is non-jailbroken. There are apps on that store that have viruses and malware on them. Does the Apple Store have malware? Do we know?
To my knowledge, I haven't heard anything.
Yeah.
So to my knowledge, no. And that would come to bear with the fact that Apple does have a fairly strict review process. The only exceptions would be for very large companies. So there's a point of contact. You know, there's someone's good name is on the line.
Yeah.
Someone's business name is on the line. So far, I haven't heard anything. And that walled garden seems to be working out for them. But at the same time, Apple iPhones themselves have had root exploits available. They've had vulnerabilities in the Safari web browser. They've had other vulnerabilities in playback, like for QuickTime, things like that. So it's not outside the realm of possibility that someone can do this, or someone could infect their phone purposefully so that they can spread an infection. That's also another possibility if you can find an exploit to an iPhone or an Android phone.
Well, it looks like in November of 2011, a hacker, relatively well-known hacker, Charlie Miller, found an exploit on bypassing the code signing restrictions that Apple iOS provides.
Hmm.
So the operating system iOS that runs on iPads and iPhones and such, iPad touches, they sign all the code and therefore to run the code, you have to get them to sign it, and they sign it through the App Store. That's the process, part of the process. And theoretically, you can't run any code that's not signed. And it looks like he found a way to disable that or bypass
circumvent it.
So if he did get an app that had that code in it to the App Store and then it was delivered to lots of people, that would be a way to bypass those security concerns. So it's possible that that stuff exists on the
But that seems to me like you're able to download an app and install it without having to jailbreak. That seems like that area rather than...
So the app that he made, the app was able to pass the review process because it didn't contain anything suspicious for the review to discover. Instead, his app downloaded the malicious code later once it had been installed on a phone or tablet. So he was able to have the app have a little bit of eval. Interesting. And I think we kind of covered that story a while ago. And the thing is, Apple's going to, of course, fight back. And Android now, the Google and that environment is going to fight back these malicious... and they're going to try to...
Yeah, after exploits like this, and Android's had other exploits, types. Not as severe as this one in the past, it really is calling into question the security of it. And to save, to make sure that people feel like they have a safe environment, they're going to have to do something.
Right. And this is a very tricky space to be in. You're trying to, one of my media heroes, Cory Doctorow, who does a lot of writing and discussion about copyright and such, talks about having a general purpose computer and then trying to restrict its abilities and use. And it's a long kind of discussion. Maybe I should actually play some of his show when he just talks about this stuff. But the general idea is that a computer is not, and a phone is not like a phone with added features that you add on to it. The phones we have, the smartphones we have, are full-function computers that can do anything a computer does. And then there's software on top of it that tries to restrict that access. And the operating system, the iOS operating system, is basically handcuffs for what the thing can do. And it's for a good reason. And it has things like, I wouldn't say spying software on it, but definitely this idea that anything that goes on has to be, looked at and investigated to try to protect the environment. Because the truth is, a certain bit of code on the computer that could, on the phone that could run whatever, could go ahead and start calling people random. There's a lot of things it could start doing.
And so, a robocall, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, having robocalls from cell phones makes a lot of sense. You get lots of phone numbers. It would be an easy thing to do and send messages to multiple phone numbers. I mean, there is a lot to be able to do on a phone, and the operating system has to lock that stuff down, which is actually breaking, if you will, the full functionality of the computer that the phone is a part of. Anyway, we can talk more about that at some other time.
Well, it's breaking it in much the same way that you have roads and lines, and there's a good reason for them to be there so that you don't have cars going multiple directions on the same lane of traffic, know, things like that.
That's akin. It's just, it's hard to express the way a computer works and how it is not a thing that downloads files and edits files. It is a full... It's a Turing complete system, and therefore can do anything a computer can do, and every single computer can do that. It's just about the kind of software that you run to determine the instruction set. But let's move on. let's talk a little bit more. Let's go ahead and talk a little bit more about privacy.
Or about Google as well. Yeah. Google has updated their privacy policy, and it's raised quite a few eyebrows, including by the Federal Trade Commission. And the change that's been made is saying we want to be able to share data between the different services. So in other words, the data that we have in Gmail, we want to be able to use it for our photos site, and the stuff in the photos site we want to be able to use for Google Plus, and for that we want to be able to use it for the calendar. And for some people, it's just a little too much control. They're feeling a little antsy about it. And from a data standpoint, it makes a lot of sense in terms of usability. So it's this really weird line that people are trying to draw to say, is this acceptable? Is this not acceptable? You have many companies coming out saying, hey, Google, don't be evil. And they're saying this type of thing is evil. At the same time, some of those companies are, like, for example, Facebook, not exactly good.
Yeah.
And have their own privacy issues. And some of them may have just like... competitive reasons to say, like, we don't want you to have more data available. But there's also that civil liberties aspect of, like, how much data do you really want to have available to this company? How much accountability do they have?
Yeah. What's interesting to me is that I assumed that Google was doing this kind of thing internally the entire time. When YouTube was bought by Google, I just assumed that any of my YouTube type viewing habits would be connected to some degree to my Gmail. I didn't assume that there was a separation of that sort. And I'm not sure why they didn't. They did have a separation. I guess it's because of historical reasons.
No, well, it's because Gmail started off as a completely separate app.
Right.
Google Docs started off as a completely separate app.
Right, so and each one of these apps, including YouTube, had their own user agreement and privacy, mm-hmm. and therefore they couldn't. They were different things, different legal right. entities to some degree,
right.
regarding privacy. So now they've released one cohesive thing which allows, as you play a YouTube video, to then get see, you know, and you go into your Gmail, you could theoretically see ads for other things that related to that YouTube video.
Right.
And it's not, I guess I'm not that concerned about it. And
although that was always
be.
The case because Google AdSense was always on all of
That's
these
true.
Pages.
Well,
so.
No, but I'm not talking about just AdSense. I'm talking about like if I search on Google for, you know, Nikon video instructions for the D7000, which I've been doing mm-hmm. this last week to see people's reviews and such. As I look at that, then when I go into my mail, even though in my mail I've never done anything regarded that, I then start talking about Canon stuff. Now, next time I do a search, it's going to give me Canon and Nikon information, even though I never searched about that on Google. You know,
right.
like it connects me as an individual that's interested in these certain things and builds a kind of profile about me. So I just something popping up on Reddit in the tech area, pretty high level right now. Don't track us. It's DONTTRACK.US is a great little graphic. It's definitely an ad for a new search engine, some group that just possibly takes the turn, takes a little flow of how Google, how as you search on Google, how your profile gets built. Right. So in this case, the example they have here is you search on Google for the term herpes, and then you get, you know, your information that you might be interested in. And then the term that is sent to the site when you actually click on one of those links talks about where you came from and what kind of browser you have and such.
And then when you go to YouTube, you see all the different jokes and skits about herpes. That's
right.
Great.
And then of course, that information is also locality based. So your IP address has an actual location. And then other advertisers get information about you, even if you haven't clicked on their ads, they get some information about you that comes from Google. So basically that one search term can start labeling your profile. Your profile can then get sold because it might be interested in certain ways. And who would buy it? Let's say an insurance company buys it. So now an insurance company buys it and decides to not cover somebody that doesn't have pre-existing whatever because they did one term for the term herpes. So there's a lot more to search results, privacy and stuff. These examples, of course, are the
right.
scary ones.
And
you're sharing medical information about yourself potentially.
And I do fear that we are scaring the trousers off people right now. And I want to give some point of context. I mean, there is some cause to worry, to yep. think about this as an issue. At the same time, not that much has changed.
No.
For example, when Lyle was just talking about being able to know your IP address, knowing your coordinates, knowing stuff like that. That has always been the case.
That's true.
A cell phone company could always say where you were, even before GPS was in the phone.
Right.
They could tell you, triangulate from the cell towers, where your cell phone was.
And with DSL as well, right? If you're using DSL or cable modem, the IP block that assigns to Ben Lomond, the town that I live in, and Felton, the town that you live in, those IP ranges are pretty well known. It's pretty easy to distinguish that, you know, even from an outside company, where you actually are.
Mm-hmm. And for that matter, if you're browsing the web, they know what your IP address is.
Right.
Like when you're connecting,
that's absolutely.
Up, it's you're
unless you're using something like Tor.
Right. But by and large, you know, 99.999% of us out there are not as anonymous as we are led to believe.
That's right. That's right.
And have never been.
Right. So one thing to think about though, when you are browsing the web, be aware that if you signed into Facebook and then you went to Google and you did something at Google and logged in the calendar system and then you go to another site, you now are connecting those things for whoever wants to know about them to some degree, because those companies have relationships and advertising, and building that profile is very easy for them to do as you slowly navigate through the web. What you should be thinking about is managing your own identity. In Chrome, there's a thing called a new incognito window. It's a way of making a new browser that has completely fresh IP, fresh cookies, basically. So when you make this new environment, you're basically duplicating your personalities online. You're allowing yourself to define when you are split personality.
Right.
And it's a very important thing to start doing when you're any kind of time you're searching the web. And I think we'll see more and more tools of this nature. Like right now, if you click on a link inside your email client, it's going to open your default browser. I wouldn't be surprised if relatively soon when you hover over the link, you'll get to choose which profile you're going to use in your browser. Or, of course, you can always copy that URL.
Yeah, and all browsers out today pretty much have a privacy mode.
Yeah.
Now, so
Firefox calls it something else. I can't even call it.
The privacy mode. Yeah.
Yeah, they all do it. So that's the way to handle it. Don't freak out and try to turn off all cookies. All the services you like are going to be turned off. And this, of course, is a trade negotiation thing where you're giving the company some information about yourself that allows them to sell more effectively and charge more and therefore give you the service more for, quote, free. But, of course, you are losing some of your privacy. And make sure you're aware of how you connect your profiles online, if you will.
Right. Now, bear in mind, this is all pretty much the U.S. that we're talking about.
Yes.
And U.S. laws and U.S. companies. Europe, on the other hand, seems to be pushing towards another side. They already have more stringent privacy laws than the U.S. by far. But there's also been a proposal throughout the European Union to have a right to be forgotten. In other words, giving citizens more rights over their data and having some controls over companies saying, if you collect data, it has to be of a limited nature. It has to be exactly for the information that you, it has to be a legitimate purpose for that information. Like, you can't just grab all the information and then try to figure out what you're going to do with it later. It has to be for a specific purpose that you're going to do. And once that purpose is finished, you have to delete the data. This is only a proposal right now, but at the same time, this is the conversations that are going on across the ocean from us. And at the same time, we're having some different discussions about how to make the data more available rather than less available.
Right. All right.
It's a curious conversation to have between them, because I think we're going to have a culture clash between those two groups before long.
Well, why?
Because we trade with one another. Because companies have to work in
both environments.
In both environments. You know, Google has a presence in the EU, and Microsoft has a presence in the EU, and Facebook has a presence in the EU.
Do you think that the EU's rules about right to be forgotten will translate into a United States rules as well? Do you think we'll see that kind of
I don't know. Honestly, I see the U.S. moving further away from privacy than enhancing privacy, to be honest, in recent years. So I don't know how that will turn out.
My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. We're both geeks, and we welcome you to ask us questions with comments or comments. Make a comment if you'd like about technology. Today's show is the January 28th, 2012 show.
I'm going to do a quick geek bit.
Oh, yeah,
one is an answer to a listener who was sending a message to us saying, can you explain what having your phone rooted means? We put out that quick term point. And we didn't explain it. And thank you so much for calling us on that. Root is the name of the user on a Unix system that can do anything, that has no restrictions. And so when you talk about any type of computer system being rooted, it's a vernacular for someone has taken over complete control of the system. And so when you have a phone and you talk about rooting your phone, rooting your Android, rooting your iPhone, what it means is that you no longer have the restrictions that have been placed on it by Apple or by whatever phone vendor you got your smartphone from. You now have complete access to it to do anything you want with that hardware. And in terms of a difference...
We use it also for the term that it's not just like there's a piece of software now that has root privileges. In fact, it's not uncommon to do that. Installers normally get root privileges. You have to put in your password on Macintosh to kind of allow them to have root privileges. That's a common task for software. It's necessary. But when we talk about rooted, we're kind of talking, or a root kit, we're talking about a bit of code that's going to stick in there and stay active and available all the time. So it's kind of like giving a secret person or an unknown person complete control of your computer indefinitely from that period
or a known person. It could be the owner of the phone wants root access. They want that full access.
But the root kit specifically kind of denotes the power of this special kit that's been put in the phone.
Right.
And it's very common for copyright holders and such to do this kind of thing. Apple, for example, has a, quote, rootkit on your phone. It is the operating system. So some people would refer to it rootkit because they want to denote that it's evil or some kind of judgment about it. But it's really just something that has root access that runs on your system.
Right. And root access refers also to Unix systems. That's where the name root came from. And as it turns out, both iPhones and Androids are Unix systems.
So, and we use the same term, a rootkit, even on a Windows machine that has no root user, because that idea is a compelling and useful way of, it's just a metaphorical idea. Mm-hmm. And we don't normally, you know, it's not like there's a thing there that's running as root. That's not exactly necessarily how it happens. If it goes into the kernel level, it's bypassing, if you will, even the user permissions structure at all completely.
Yeah, or if you make the root password available. That is...
That's what happened to the GeekSpeak server, actually.
Right. That's the ability to get access to the system.
And keep in mind that when we know what's running on the system, it's because the system's telling us what's running on it, right? So if you have a bit of code that's running on a system that wants to hide itself and it has that high-level ability to run as root, it can hide that it's even running. Like it's
not just as root. You actually have to patch the kernel, running kernel.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which is normally something that happens when a rootkit's installed, a kernel patch.
Right.
Kernel modification, yeah. So then what you do is you take applications that actually you normally would run to tell you what's happening on the system, like Top, which is a great little app in a Unix environment that tells you all the applications are running. You can modify that code and therefore not show the app that's actually running that's controlling the machine. This is all very simplistic, of course, the way we're describing this, because it has to be, because the actual complexity is excessive. But I think that's a good rundown of what it is. The great question. Was that a geek bit? I don't know if that was a geek bit, but I think we'll stick with that.
Yeah, we talked geeky about it.
Yeah.
Totally a geek bit.
All right. Well, one more. We normally do a geek term of the week, and so I think we'll use that rooting as our geek term of the week as well, because it seems like a perfect example of that. All right. So we'll go ahead and start taking calls with questions and comments about technology. Miles, do you have a preference on these calls? Should we just do them in order?
Because we're just do them in order.
All right. From Asheville, North Carolina, Eli, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Eli, yes.
Eli, sorry. Hi. Sorry. Hi.
Talked to you guys a few weeks ago about a server thing for my computer, but got back from my wedding honeymoon in Hawaii.
Congratulations.
And while we were there, we went and got a tour of the Mauna Loa Atmospheric Observatory.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
And
awesome.
I just wanted to give a couple comments on how impressed I was with all the scientific controls they use. They're the ones who have a history of the CO2 levels in the atmosphere dating back to 1958.
Right.
And their levels of control on the experiments are really impressive. They have standardized gases that they test, like standard tanks, and then they'll only use a little bit of it and send it back for retesting to make sure it hasn't fluctuated. They'll share tanks throughout the world with different observatories. They'll also do blind controls where the home laboratory will send them a tank and won't tell them what it is, and they have to test it and tell them what it is and to make sure that the equipment's accurate. And, you know, it's just level upon level upon level.
Is your new married spouse as interested in technology and science as you are? Or was she...
She thinks it's cool, but she's not as geeky as I am.
Okay. But would you recommend it to even non-geeks to go see the atmospheric observatory?
Yeah, actually...
If you're a geek, definitely. They ask you to schedule a couple weeks in advance. The guy giving the tour was actually one of the climatologists, like the director of the research observatory. So, I mean, it's pretty impressive. One of the other guys on a tour was author of several books on climate change. Like, it's not a really touristy thing, but if you're a geek, you should make it one.
Yeah. What I find interesting about things like Mauna Loa and other observatories, as well as scientific experiments that are done with regard to NOAA, Oceanographic and Atmosphere, is that, like you were saying with regard to the Atmospheric Observatory, Eli, is that all of these installations are incredibly complex and incredibly fascinating. And you really don't know that until you set foot in and take a look around and get a tour.
And
so I highly recommend
see the people doing the work and you know what they're like. I highly recommend it as well. Thank you so much, Eli, for the recommendation. So go to Mauna Loa if you're in Hawaii and go to take a look at the atmospheric
and go to any observatory that happens to be nearby, because you don't know what they're doing until you go there. It's amazing.
Eli, thanks for the call.
No problem. And if you happen to just be in the South Pole, they've got one there too.
Sweet. Take care. We'll go ahead and take a call from Santa Cruz, more closer to home. Hal, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. Thanks for finally getting around to talking about rooting, although I have to confess I still don't really. I was the one that called in earlier and asked that you discuss that.
Okay.
I'll look it up on Wikipedia and send you a question. Following up on the guy who just called, not the reason I called, but NASA has just released a 26-second video showing how temperatures around the world have warmed since 1880.
Cool.
We have 131 years of global climate, of global temperatures in 26 seconds. And you can find it at climatecentral.org.
We will put it up on geekspeak.org.
Yeah. And if you Google Climate Central, it came up for me as the fourth hit. It's a long link, so I didn't want to.
We'll set it up and put it on geekspeak.org so everybody can find it.
The question I have is about all this privacy stuff and the exploitation of the information that we allow or unwittingly allow Google and everyone else to get from us. And it's the question about the trade-off between they've got to find a way to support what they're giving you free. It's not really free. It's an exchange, and I think one of you made a comment to that effect. But with the push toward open source publishing and everybody being connected all the time and wanting to have instant access to information, and I'm probably, you know, near the top of those who want that. I always want to be able to just, you know, use a smartphone or a computer. But can I get that for free? And where are we headed with this?
What do you mean? Can get what for free?
Well, when I do a search on Google, you know, they've spent a lot of money to give me the answer to my question.
Right. No, there's definitely. I mean, we definitely should be aware the entire time. I mean, it's very much like if somebody runs into you on the mall and says, hey, I want to give you this free thing. You know that there's a reason why they're doing that transaction. It's not like they're just giving free stuff to people. That's very rare. Most of the time, your first reaction is, what's it going to cost me? You know, what's your pitch? What are you trying to sell me? Google, at least to some degree, it's relatively transparent what it is.
Okay,
just like television networks, the same thing. You know, we give it to you for free. You watch our commercials.
So my question is, given the potential for communication and instant access and all of that, and the fact that I edit entries on Wikipedia, I don't get paid for doing that, and that information becomes available. But is anybody thinking about how in the future we can minimize the cost,
the social cost,
to us, to me, of being exploited or whatever? I mean, what is it? You know, two generations, three generations beyond the way Google and Yahoo and everybody is.
Well, to answer your first question, is anybody thinking about it? Yes, the European Union absolutely has been thinking about it for some time. They actually have internet privacy laws on the books already, and have further legislation still being discussed to tighten things down there. And it is a difficult conversation because, as we've talked about on Geek Speak before, convenience and security are mutually exclusive much of the time.
Yeah.
The more convenient it is to get something, more convenient it is for someone to illicitly take it as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want to, if you lock everything down so you can't, so no one can get to it, then you also make it so that you can't use it either. It's just,
and people are thinking about this quite a bit. In fact, it's a very active research space in the program that I work up at UCSC. My friend and colleague Warren Sack is very much involved in the dialogue about how you describe privacy and security and what the language is around it. Because one of the things we run into is not really having a verbose enough segment of our language defined around these strange concepts of extremely social, private, secure environments, right? It used to be that you locked your door and you assume that your neighbors won't break into your windows, and that's your home
it
privacy.
It used to be we had a tribe of 50 people around
right.
us.
And it just wasn't. So the language that we've emerged to describe these ideas are all, you know, they're metaphoric and stretched and hard to deal with. And that's one of the problems with trying to figure out how to do what they're doing. I mean, Facebook is trying to be in a space where they're successful and use our information at the same time. And yet people get frustrated every time they change any kind of policy. And a big reason for that is it's really hard to communicate what, you know, what they're doing, what they can do, and what's appropriate for everybody. So the dialogue around it's even difficult. We don't even have the language for it. So there are people looking at this, or people talking about it. We talk about it quite a bit. I think that the scary part, the, you know, the science fiction writers' part, the Orwellian's ideas, are real. Like, you really need to be thinking about the worst case scenario in all these situations. What does happen if Google gets an injunction from the federal government? The federal government can just look at any kind of content and do profiles on people. Or a major healthcare system finds out everybody that's ever searched on any type of cancer and therefore raise the rates of their insurance because they did that. These things could happen quite easily, and we need to be aware of that. And I think at the same time, just like any social concern, you have to have some faith that the society will handle it and make the rules and regulations available as we get more deeper and deeper into the reliance upon it. I know that's kind of abstract, but I think right now that's the space we're in. We're learning and investigating most of the time.
Well, when genetic analysis began happening, and I'm going back, you know, at least 30 years now, there was a fear that if you had a blood test, that the results of that blood test could also be used by an insurance company to deny you coverage or whatever if you had, you know, like the BRCA.
Right, and so we have rules and regulations about the blood that's donated.
So there is a little bit of background from that with respect to medical insurance and so on. On the other side of it, I use Google Analytics to find out, you know, where people came from to visit the websites I'm responsible for.
Sure.
And what pages they landed on and how long they stayed there. And on the one side, I'm not exploiting anybody. I'm trying to provide a better service.
Right,
and that
right.
information is valuable to me.
Well, but and at the same time, aren't you trying to exploit somebody? If you find out that a whole bunch of people are looking at you from a certain area of Tampa, isn't that some kind of privacy issue? Like, why is that whole area in Tampa looking at me? That's
I'm not selling anything.
Well, it's not even about selling something, though. It's also just about the knowledge that they're granting you by going to your site. I mean, I think that the important thing is that we keep looking at this and not just assume that everything's going to be taken care of. So thanks, Hal, for the call.
Okay,
appreciate it.
You guys.
All right, take care. Hal's a regular caller to GeekSpeak. I don't know about if everybody else is, but I love it when I hear from people I've been talking to for years. we'll go ahead and take another call. This time, we'll take one from Capitola. Sandra, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have my iMac at home, my desktop, and I have it on cable modem. And at work, they gave me an HP laptop, and I can't plug it into my cable modem.
Does your cable modem have multiple ports on the back of it, or just one? Meaning the cable that connects your computer to your modem, is that the only place?
It just has one.
Okay, so you actually do have a cable modem, and most likely not a cable router.
Right.
Sometimes they're modems and routers. And you actually do want to have a router in there, some kind of smart device that will protect your machine from being a public IP address. And it's kind of a crucial thing. We call it a hardware firewall because it provides that service. I think firewall was last week's or 2 weeks ago's term of the week if you want to hear us rant about firewall. But what I would suggest to you is to get a home router. And normally you can get a wireless router that will have, you know, wireless and some ports.
But the question was why when she unplugged, I'm assuming you're unplugging your iMac and plugging in the laptop,
right.
But the laptop doesn't work.
Miles, right.
That usually has to do with the MAC address for the network interface.
Unique identifier for the network device hardware on your computer.
Right. In other words, the cable modem has looked and said, oh, well, this person's computer has this ID, and we're only going to listen to this ID. And there are some good reasons for it. One way you can get around it a lot of times is turning off the cable modem. Sometimes they'll have a battery backup, so you have to take the battery out as well. And then you turn it back on, plug it back in, and plug it into the laptop, and it'll resync to that MAC address.
Yeah, and the other thing, though, is that sometimes doing that can erase your settings on the modem, on how the modem's operating.
I haven't run across that problem before, but it's a problem. At the same time, this is an issue that people come across all the time, especially when they're putting in, when they get like a home gateway kit like Lyle is suggesting. And one of the ways around that is figuring out what your MAC address is for the existing computer and then telling the router to pretend that it's this other computer. And you can, but that ends up being a bit more complex.
Yeah, so. Because the other thing you have to do is you have to change the MAC address on your computer as well, or they'll have conflicting MAC addresses even though they're on a different subnet. So
what I would suggest is getting a home gateway kit, just like Lyle suggested. Try turning off the cable modem and unplugging any batteries if there is one in there.
And a really important thing is in your cable modem that you get, there's going to be like multiple network ports on the back. They're called RJ45. They look like a really big phone plug. And that that device should have four of them that are just sequentially numbered, like 1 through 5, whatever, however many they are. And then there'll be another one that has the initial
The instructions
WAN.
Will be in the box for whatever home router you
get. One of the ports will say WAN, a wide area network, WAN. That's the one you want to connect to your modem, and the rest of them can be connected to your computers. And good luck on it. Right. Don't forget that your cable provider should provide tech support for this kind of thing at some level. And another thing to keep in mind that when you're diagnosing this and you want to get help, lots of times they suggest going to the website, which you won't be able to do if you break your network connection. So having a smartphone with you sometimes helps.
Right. If you have a geek friend, I mean, I'm not even talking about someone who is a super kernel hacker, you know, guru.
Right.
This is actually one of the more basic things that people will know. So if you know someone who is even marginally decent with computers, they should be able to help out in hooking that up. And then if you run into problems, then you can call up your cable provider and ask for more help there.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sandra.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. We're taking calls with questions and comments about technology. We just took a call from Aptos, and we're going to take another one from Aptos. And you know, one thing about this board is I'm definitely crossed hands all the time. Commentary about things you can't see. Yes, here on Geek Speak. From Aptos, Ed, welcome to Geek Speak.
How you doing?
Good.
Only got a couple minutes left, so I'll be sort of quick. Been waiting for months to put together a X79 chip system. I wanted to go. I try and go AMD, but they're just falling too far behind this time, so I'm going to go with the i7-3930K chip once it gets into volume after the C2 step comes out. And I've been looking at motherboards, and it's come down to two pretty much. And I don't know how much you guys know about the motherboards, which is my question. The Asus.
I'll just stop you there. We don't.
Well, one, there's an issue of we don't want to go into endorsing specific brands and that type of thing. But
I haven't built an Intel machine for maybe 3 years.
I have, but at the same time, you're asking about which one is going to be the absolute best performance in there. And I think.
No, I'm not asking that. I'm asking EVGA is low enough volume that they're not releasing boards for free for sites. Mm-hmm. And people to review, and yet they've got a board that's got an awful lot of nice features on it.
I wouldn't get a board that doesn't have lots of reviews.
Right.
I think that the review process in the hardware space, especially in there, is extremely important. The companies that actually look at the boards do. I mean, and the excuse that we're doing a low run, we're not going to send them out. I mean, if they're going to send them out to some people, there's got to be. There's, you know, 7 or 8 sites that if you don't have reviews on those sites with that hardware, why even look at it?
Yeah, if you're trying to eke out every last bit of performance, then it becomes really important which board you get. Yeah. Otherwise, they're pretty
similar.
The next thing to do,
if you do want to get that board because it's got these awesome specs, go take a look at the past history of the boards that they've released and look what the reviews say. And make sure to read in there at the same time that, was it really easy right out of the box, or did they have to wait for a few different driver updates from the manufacturer? Like a reviewer will go run into a problem where all of a sudden USB is not working on the board or something crazy like that. They can't figure it out. They'll communicate with the vendor. The vendor will go, oh, you have the wrong this or that. And they'll send off a driver package. So it's very possible that if that process doesn't exist, you're going to be in a situation where you can't access something very fundamental and you have to wait for them to release a driver. So if you want to do that kind of level of, you know, kind of be that beta test run, fine. But I would definitely go with boards that have some reviews behind them. That process is important.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you so much for the call.
Bye-bye.
Miles, I was certain we wouldn't be able to answer that question just because how much I don't know about motherboards. But that general idea is pretty good.
Yeah. In general, when people are talking about product numbers, we're not going to be able to help you just because technology changes so quickly, and there's no way that we can keep track of every single model number from every single vendor. But at the same time, there are some good rules of thumb, and that's what we're trying to impart here on the show, is just the answers to what is computer common sense rather than what is the end-all be-all.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and broadcasting at kosp.org. My name is Lyle Troxell. Miles and I have been doing Geek Speak for a while. Miles, I found the first time I hosted Geek Speak, I found that MP3 file, and I sound ridiculously bad. It's fantastic. It's from 2000.
Is that where you're talking in staccato?
Oh, yeah. You remember that? Before I learned how to go too fast so people can't understand me. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. One call that we didn't get, Brandon from Salinas called, sorry about this, about creating apps. What to do? How do you do it? There are some, if you're using iPhone apps, there are some wonderful resources at Stanford. You can go to iTunes U. You do have to do iPhone's apps. You do have to have an Intel type Macintosh to do that. Apple releases the development stuff
web
for free.
Unless
you're doing web app. That's true. That's true. And there's great resources in iTunes U. Stanford releases like whole courses on it. I highly recommend it. For KOSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned now for the Car Guys, Click and Clack, the Tap Brothers.